Welcome to... Hey, Great Shot. This is the Great Shot Podcast, a Crack Rackets and Tennis Channel Podcast Network production. My name is Alex Gruskin. In case you listeners did not already know, our Crack Rackets team had the tremendous opportunity last weekend to travel down to Knoxville, Tennessee for one of the inaugural events on the 2021-2022 college tennis calendar. It was the Knoxville Showdown, featuring, in my opinion, four of the top 25 teams in the nation in host Tennessee, plus Kentucky, Columbia, and Pepperdine. Of course, it's an early fall event, and while there are no implications for the winter and spring dual match season, it is always fascinating to see so many new faces competing on court for the first time in their college tennis careers. It's always interesting to see the developments of the returning starters, how those developments will factor into the impending dual match season, and of course, on a personal note, it's just great to get back down on campuses in that college tennis atmosphere. Of course, it's second to none. Even when you're playing hidden dual matches, which are not technically the team format, every match counts individually, but you know, you have six guys from the same teams lined up next to each other. You have these doubles points happening simultaneously. The momentum swings, the energy, it's contagious, and it's what makes, in my opinion, college tennis the most entertaining, the most electric form of tennis in the game. Of course, on today's show, what I want to do is recap that 2021 Knoxville Showdown, offer my biggest takeaways from the event, talk about the players who stood out, talk about how I feel about each of these teams heading into 2022, because I sincerely do think each of them supremely talented. Each of them can make some serious noise here in the college tennis season. Of course, before I get into it, I do want to remind all of you, we had the chance to speak with so many of the players, coaches from this event. You can hear those conversations on our Cracked Interviews podcast over the next few weeks. I got the chance to speak with Emil Hud, Mark Wallner of Tennessee, got the chance to speak with Austin Huang, Alex Kotzen of Pepperdine. I also spoke with Columbia coach Howard Endelman back at Kalamazoo about a month ago. I spoke with James McKay, the associate head coach for Tennessee before the start of the event. I'm going to get Schachterly, head coach of, I call him Ad. I mean, him and I have had the chance to get to know each other a little bit, which I am very fortunate to have as a fact. Anyways, point is to say, I'm going to get him on the pod pretty soon. I'm going to get Cedric, Matt Gordon, one of the guys. I've told the story before. He, Pete Billingham, were my coaches when I went down to Saddlebrook when I was much younger and still thought, hey, maybe I want to play tennis in college. Maybe I do have some talent. I've since learned I do not, but you know, Matt, Pete, I could draw a direct line for their tolerance of my, and I went down with a former high school teammate named Blake Burstein, who I could argue was the original podcast co-host for these Great Shot podcasts in their earliest days when I was 14, 15, 16, chatting tennis all the time. Nevertheless, their tolerance of mine and Blake's nonsense was one of those confirming moments when you're, you know, young in life and you're like, oh man, they're enjoying this. Maybe I am better at talking tennis than I thought. Anyways, all of this is to say, I'm going to get those two coaches on the podcast sometime soon. So be on the lookout for that content. Be on the lookout for all of those Cracked Interviews podcasts to drop over the next few weeks. You can find those wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can, of course, find them on our website, crackedrackets.com. If you are looking for U.S. Open recap content, we recap the men's and women's events on our mini break podcast feed. We talked all things women's singles with Tennis Channel editorial producer David Kane. We talked all things men's singles with Monday Match Analysis host, friend of the program, Gil Gross. Again, those conversations can be found on the Mini Break podcast feed. But you didn't come here to hear the plugs. You came here to hear me talk about the Knoxville Showdown. So with that in mind, let's get into it. And what I'm going to do, break down the results day by day, talk about the developments for each of these teams, offer my final thoughts on each team at the end as well, where I project them in the immediate, you know, my initial reaction, where I can see them perhaps, you know, competing at this season. And then, of course, as we get into it, it's worth just reminding all of you, we're about a month away from the kickoff of our college tennis season preview content. We'll break down our top 10 teams heading into the year, hopefully have the chance to interview the head coaches from each of those teams. Of course, Chris Halioris, Matt Stachowiak going to get back in the loop. We've got some other fun things planned as well, so be on the lookout for all that. We're a month away, folks, a month away from the preview content. We're getting ready to rock and roll here at Crack Rackets. We hope all of you will get excited for that as well. But with that in mind, let's get into the 2021 Knoxville Showdown. And again, just the format for all of you listeners throughout the course of the weekend. Same scoring we always use. So when they played doubles, it was one set, no ad scoring, tiebreaker at 6-0. When we played singles, it was two out of three sets, full third sets, which, you know, at times was not appreciated because I was like, I want to go watch Michigan-Washington at the same time. No, it was great to just see these players compete. Great to see them try and get their sea legs back under them. And, you know, again, to play three sets, we got right into it. No chasers. Let's get into the college tennis season. Of course, each match counted individually. So it wasn't like, oh, Pepperdine wins 5-2. Oh, Kentucky wins 4-1 or whatever it may be. But again, it was your basic college tennis format. And talking to coaches who played, particularly SEC coaches who, you know, had the opportunity last fall to compete because the Big Ten wasn't able to. And, you know, there were, for the SEC teams, they had the chance to play many hidden duels throughout the course of last fall because there weren't your traditional regional events, your traditional individual traveling. There was, you know, the opportunity, if you're going to travel, try and bring the whole team, make the most of it, because obviously given the pandemic, those opportunities were few and far between. And, you know, talking to coaches who had the opportunity to play those hidden duels last fall, they cannot emphasize enough how critical they were to the development of their team, because to have the opportunity to have all of your guys competing in one place, to be able to replicate to the, you know, closest of abilities, the pressures of a dual match, the momentum swings, the energy it takes to, you know, complete a 3-hour victory, as so many of these college tennis matches are, and not only the, you know, the more importantly perhaps, the focus it takes for a team to sustain that sort of energy from start to finish. These hidden dual matches in the fall, incredibly valuable. It's not going to surprise me to see more and more coaches across the country try and schedule more and more of them moving forward because, you know, again, A, it's the best preparation for their players, but B, it's damn entertaining too. I mean, we got to essentially see, and yes, we were missing some faces. For Tennessee, there was no Adam Walton all weekend long. Now, he's competing this week at a Futures in Champaign, and that's good news because I know this weekend they didn't have him competing because it was, again, it was a tentative concern about an injury. It was playing it safe, not pressing him and forcing him into the action too soon, but he's ready to compete again at the Futures this week, so obviously that's a good note moving forward. Of course, for Kentucky, no Draxel, no Melancharian. That was their, you know, two of their top three players, Liam Draxel, preseason number one in the ITA singles rankings. That said, we have no questions about Draxel. We know what Hurrian can do. And, you know, for them, Gabe Diallo, who was an All-American last season, he played his first match on day one. He then withdrawn from the rest of the action. He was also nursing an injury. And I know, you know, looking back, Alex Kotsen beats him on day one, and I'll get into that momentarily. But, you know, talking to some people around Columbia, they, you know, maybe shouldn't have played that match. Just, again, get him fully healthy heading towards January. Now, that's not trying to make an excuse or diminish anything about Kotsen's victory and the level he showed this weekend, which, believe me, I'm going to be talking about on this show. That is to say, the Kentucky we saw this weekend is not a fully loaded Kentucky. And yet, I think that's the place I want to start on day one, because the question for this Kentucky team, what do, you know, four singles, five singles, six singles look like? Because you look at this Kentucky team, they bring back a ton of talent. And obviously, it starts at the top. Liam Draxel last year, 21-2 in dual matches as a freshman. Imagine what he's going to do with a second year under his belt. And having the chance to see Draxel compete last year, and I believe it was semifinals of the NCAAs for him. The guy's energy is contagious. The grind, the fight, the way he just problem solves, the energy he brings, match in, match out, that's what you want out of your number one singles. He is the beating heart and obviously the shining light at the top for this Kentucky lineup. And when you have that combination at the top of your lineup, it just inspires everyone else, you know, on the way down. Trickle-down economics doesn't work, folks. Don't worry. I'm not going to get into that right now. Trickle-down momentum absolutely freaking works. in college tennis. Just look at the Stevie Johnson teams. Look at the Samdev Devarman teams. Look at the John Isner teams. I can go on and on and on. Petros Frisokos at two singles for Wake Forest, just knowing, and I mean Gojo at 1-2, just knowing, all right, we're going to win those two matches every time, or knowing, all right, we're up 1-0 because we have Petros. We're up 1-0 because we have J.J. Wolf. That, I mean, goes without saying. When you have the best player in college tennis, usually it helps your team. And obviously for Kentucky, you know, there's not every team can say that. Going into the season, maybe 10 teams can make an argument, we think we have the best player in the country. Kentucky is one of those 10 teams. You can say it legitimately in Liam Draxel. So again, that's what they have coming back at number one singles. He wasn't there this weekend. Number two singles, Milan Hurrian, the fifth year senior, who was 12-3 last season at number three singles, 16-4 overall. He was 4-1 when he was called up to the number two singles position. I think he just made a futures at a 25K in England as well. He's another guy who I believe is playing at the futures in Champaign this weekend. Again, he's a veteran who, if you get at the two and three singles, a guy who's going to scrap and claw and doesn't have the biggest game but does a lot of different things. And another guy whose energy, his fight, it's what defines this Kentucky team. And so, again, you don't have questions about Hurrian going into next season playing at number three. You don't have questions about Diallo when he plays his best tennis. That serve, his forehand, the front foot tennis, power tennis he can play on his best days, he's going to compete with anyone. I don't care how good, even if it's Sam Rifus, even if it's Johannes Munday, even if it's, you know, any of the quality number two, or honestly, if he's playing three behind Hurrian, who knows? But like that, you feel pretty good you're going to get one of those at two and three singles. You feel pretty good you're going to get Draxel at one point. The question is, what do you do four through six? And you look for this Kentucky team last season, 19-8 overall, four through six singles positions. They were 14-11. That's a 56% win percentage, 13-7 at 5, 10-10 at 6. You look for them in doubles during the season. They were 15-10 at 1 doubles, 16-5 at 2 doubles, and then 11-13 at 3 doubles. So that means they're winning the doubles about 50% of the time, and then a lot of the times they're finding, all right, we win doubles, we win one, we win two, we win three. That's how we get through the Auburns, the Arkansas, the Vanderbilts, who are all really, really good teams. I'm not trying to slight them. I'm just saying that's where Kentucky separates itself from some of the other teams in the SEC. The problem for them is when you're facing a Florida, when you're facing a Tennessee, when you're facing a Georgia in A&M, you know, they're, that 1, 2, and 3 is not going to cut it. You can't go into the best of the best and say, well, we'll win the top three. Like, you just can't bank on that no matter who you are. I don't care if you're the Virginia teams. I don't care if you're any of these teams, because the top three is for every school. How are you going to win three against Rifus, Andrade, and Vale? How are you going to win three against Walton, Munday, and let's say Hud this year? You know, again, last year, how are you going to win three against Vacherot, Habib, and Aguilar? You just weren't. And so, you know, for this Kentucky team, the thing that they have coming into this season, not only do they keep their top three, but everyone who competed for those spots 4, 5, 6 last year, they're back. And they all look damn good as well. And the guy I want to start with here as we talk about the day one results, and I know that's setting the scene for Kentucky more broadly, but I think Kentucky's a fascinating team. And I won't lie, I was wrong. And I want to give shout out to my guy Jay, you know, at Jay, I think it's John Tweets Tennis now. I apologize. I used to have your Twitter handle locked in, but now you've got a new one. Point being, He made the argument Kentucky's closer to a top 10 than a top 16 team. And while I did list out the exercise, who are my initial top 10 teams going into the season, and I think I can get to 10 before you have to say firmly no, Kentucky is absolutely better than that team. But Kentucky's on that short list. There's a group of teams, I would say like 9 through 14, you know, a fellow conference member in South Carolina. I would argue Michigan, Illinois are probably in that fringe conversation. You say TCU without Gray, probably still a hair above, but right around there as well. You know, you start to get to the USC's of the world, Arizona's of the world. That's why I say they're closer to 16 than just definitive top 10, but they are absolutely on the fringes of that, you know, 8 through 12 range. That's the sort of talent this Kentucky team has. The question for them, can they figure out doubles and can they figure out 4 through 6? And, you know, again, one of the guys who I think is going to help perhaps answer those questions is Joshua Lapidot, who is the talented sophomore out of London, Ontario. Lefty, plays just, you know, an aggressive game style, moves forward, plays on his terms, will, you know, fluid in the outer thirds, but will quickly try to go from defense to offense, try to get to the net, just put pressure on his opponents, and you look for Lopadad throughout the course of the weekend. Started out on day one. He earns a three-set win over the supremely talented freshman Hugo Hashimoto of Colombia. For Lopadad was a 7-6, 5-7, 6-3 victory. Believed he served for that first set up 5-4 against Hashimoto. Hashimoto was able to break back, get the set to a breaker. But then, you know, again, the aggression Lopadad played with. You're playing a freshman in his first match, first week at on campus. You should be the aggressor. Force him to do the amazing. Force him to hit these passing shots in the outer third, slap forehands, and just, you know, the pace Hashimoto can play with. He hits the ball big, folks. I would argue from the baseline, he hit about as big of a ball as anyone I saw compete over the course of the weekend, and that includes Monday, and that includes Kotsen, and all of these different guys. The difference is Lopadat's power was more controlled, and you look for him. I believe he's ranked number 71 right now. For him last season, you know, it was up and down. 6-9 overall in the dual match season. He was 2-2 at the three singles position, 0-4 at the four singles position, but 4-3 when he played 5-6, 4-3 in his last 10 results. And look, again, when he was pushed at that number 3 and 4 singles position, it was a little bit tougher for him last season, but he's a season more developed. And I just think that, I mean, I know four singles players to have that sort of and I'm not saying Lopadat's going to even play four, because you've got other guys in the lineup now, such as Musatelli, the transfer from Old Dominion, such as, you know, again, I'll go through the list momentarily as I go through their results, but you look at what Lopadat was able to do, the aggression he plays with, and that, you know, he was playing outdoors, and that aggression still translates. You look for him, you know, the next day for Lopadat, it was a three-set loss for him against Andrew Rogers. Rogers, of course, playing on his home turf. Rogers now transferring to Pepperdine, but played his undergrad years before transferring now as a product of pursuing film school at Pepperdine. He beats Lopadat in three sets, but Rogers is a guy who's going to be playing 2-3 singles, and Lopadat was right there with him throughout the course of the match. I thought he competed really well. That was two guys on their front foot. That was just damn good tennis. I thought that was a good result for him. Again, I thought he competed really well in both of his matches, and for him to get the win over Hashimoto, who will be playing top four for Colombia, and, you know, three sets with Rogers, yeah, you want him to get over the finish line there, but I thought it was a really good weekend for Lopadat. And again, the lefty, the aggression he plays with, even if it's not four singles, five singles, six singles, that sort of talent, I think it could be an answer for Kentucky. He was a guy who stood out to me. You know, I thought J.J. Mercer, transfer from Ohio State, the redshirt sophomore, he was also excellent throughout the weekend. And you look for Mercer, he and Lopadat partnered together in doubles. They earned a 6-1 win over the duo of Finkelstein and Horvat for Colombia. They also earned a 6-4 win over DeJong and Hadigian of Pepperdine. Look, J.J. Mercer's just seen a lot of good tennis early in his college tennis career. And, you know, even though he wasn't cracking the lineup for Ohio State with consistency, there's just a value to being in that program. The expectations that come at Ohio State and, you know, the work that they put in day in, day out, even if you're not in the lineup. If you're on a Ty Tucker roster, you are practicing as if you are the number one player in the nation, expected to win every match at number one singles. And again, Mercer was ready for the showdown this weekend. You look for him, he earns a 7-6, 6-1 victory in his first match in his second match against Pepperdine over Timmy Zietvogel. Zietvogel, the tricky lefty. Mercer just able to continue to move forward, absorb that first strike. Yeah, he's not the biggest guy in stature, but he just plays with an aggression and a creativity in the outer thirds. Great feel around the court. Again, he just was able to, Zietvogel wasn't quite able to hurt him enough, penetrate the court with enough ease, and, you know, Mercer was able to flip the script. He's just a really well-rounded player. I think for sure we're going to see J.J. Mercer in the doubles lineup for Kentucky. He also earned a 1-3 win over Ishan Ravichandar, one of the many first years playing in Colombia's lineup for Mercer. It was a 1-3 victory, and again, you're not going to, Mercer was playing on technically courts like 3 and 4 this weekend. And I know it was a hidden duel, and I know there were players missing, but you're going to be asking J.J. Mercer to play 5, 6 singles, maybe 4. Like, sure, you have your top 3 set. This is what I keep saying. And to have J.J. Mercer in the mix as a 5, as a 6 singles, it's not a lock, But he's going to be damn competitive in every match he plays. And again, that's the sort of guy who just finds ways to win, the sort of guy you want in your lineup, that sort of energy, again, the confidence he plays with. Certainly, I know he's going to be contributing in doubles. I think he's in that rotation for the six singles mix. The guy, to me, who stood out as the most six singlesy of the players who I saw competing was Yasha Zemel. And you look for Zemel, who I believe is a sophomore out of Israel. Indeed, for Zemel. Yep, sophomore out of Haifa, Israel. For Zemel last season, 7-6 overall in dual matches, 2-0 at four singles, 4-4 at five, 1-2 at six. I can't explain what a six singles energy is, but he has it. Just the grind, the competitiveness, and to outgrind Austin Huang, who was playing his first match back in 18 months, but was undefeated in the bottom half of Colombia's lineup through the start of their 2020 season. Zemel grinded him down and was able to win that match 6-1. And then for Zemel, the next day, he bounces back, 4-5 win over the bigger hitting, big forehand of Eric Hedigi, and he was just able to absorb it, redirect it. I just think he competes extraordinarily well. I think that's a guy you put at six singles. He's never going to be the first one off court. That's not the guy you're worried, oh, he got blown out 0-0. It's, let's say it's at 3-2 dual match scenario, and it comes down to Draxel and Riffis at one and Zemel and Gujar at six. And Zemel's just down there fighting and scrapping and giving Draxel a chance to earn the win, to just give Kentucky some momentum. And then, he's the sort of guy I think can ride that momentum. I know I'm talking very, qualitatively. These are not quantitative qualities, but there's just a way Zemel competes. I was impressed by it. And so obviously you go 2-0. He was a standout performer. For Francois Musatelli, it just kind of sucked because first set he wins against Finkelstein on day one of Colombia, 6-3, and just, I guess I'm going team by team here, so we'll start with the Kentucky breakdown. I've sort of shifted the format of this podcast, by the way. I'll just go team by team, my reactions for each of them. You look for, again, you look for Francois Musatelli, the transfer from Old Dominion, wins that first set 6-3 against Finkelstein. Finkelstein withdraws from an injury. Next match, he just played a guy in Daniel Jajong, the guy on court one for Pepperdine this week, who was on fire all weekend long, and I'll get to him momentarily. But Alan Musatelli competed well, give himself a chance to win a 7-6 first set. Unfortunately, DeJong's a little bit more solid in the breaker. And again, DeJong gives you chances. That's his game style. He's going to give you chances to attack, but then if you fall asleep at the wheel, he's going to slap a forehand winner by you. He's going to step up and get his momentum behind one of those backhands, go down the line. And still, I think Musatelli competed really well at that top flight. You're going to be asking him to step into your lineup in a 4, 5, or 6 singles position. He's certainly talented enough to do so. And then, again, there's a lot of guys, whether it's Sorbo, whether it's Chen, whether it's LeBlanc, there is still other talent to sift through for this Kentucky roster. I mean, you look for them, a guy I didn't mention yet, again, Jonathan Sorbo, 3-0 last year in the dual matches that he played. And you look just up and down the lineup, they've got a lot of guys who can compete. And so I do think this Kentucky team, it's going to be fascinating to see what they do at the bottom half of their singles. If they can find, honestly, even one more guy, if they can figure out, even if they're shifting, even if it's 4 is mixing around, 5 is mixing around, let's say they just figure out this is our 6, or, again, this is our 5, and we'll figure out the 4 and 6 as we go. Now you've got 4 really, really good spots in your singles lineup, and it just gives you that margin for error. Now, for them moving forward, it's tough to judge their doubles when there's no Draxel, no Hurrian, who will both be in the doubles lineup, and, you look for them this weekend. I do think Mercer, Lapidot, those are guys, that's a team. What you do with Diallo, again, their top 3, Diallo, Draxel, Hurrian, will all be in the doubles lineup. I do think Lapidot, Mercer, both get in the mix. Game style-wise, it makes sense. I mean, you look at the big serving for them of Alexander LeBlanc. I believe 6'5", right, is LeBlanc. Yeah, 6'5". There's a place for that body, that serve, certainly in the doubles lineup. They've got bodies. The thing is, can you find teams? Can you find the options? That's the thing for Kentucky, because if they go up 1-0, I don't know how you find 4 singles wins against them. If they're down 1-0, they can definitely find 4 singles wins. But if they go up 1-0, if they can figure out that doubles, now they are a top 10 team. Because you're just, again, to go and, well, we'll beat Draxel. Probably not. We'll beat Diallo. Hopefully, but probably not. We're probably not going to win at 3 singles, whether it's Diallo or it's Hurrian, and whoever it is, that's a really damn good 3 singles. And then with all these lines, like, again, okay, you say you sweep the bottom three. Like, I don't think that's going to be the case for this Kentucky team this season. I think they've got a lot of guys, a lot of talent. Obviously, they're going to be tested continuously in the SEC conference play. They're going to have chances to figure out who's working, who isn't, take their lumps. But, man, I was impressed by this Kentucky team. I mean, I was impressed by all of the teams, sincerely. That's why I say they're each top 25 moving in. And I think the place I want to go next is about this Pepperdine team. Because, first of all, to get back to that Daniel DeJong thought, just a thought exercise for all of you listeners. And I've been texting this around in my circles and asking. So some of you may be listening to this. If I've already texted you this, I apologize. I don't think I tweeted it. I don't think I did. But there's been a lot of tweets over the last few weeks, folks. So I apologize if I don't remember all of them. That said, who's the best player in California next season? I mean, seriously, ponder it to yourself. Who's the best player? Because the Kooky Monster, Daniel Kuckerman, he's gone. With all due respect to Keegan Smith, with the injury he sustained, I'm not going to put any expectations on anything for Keegan. So, you know, if we get to see Keegan play, hopefully that's a win in itself. Hopefully he's as close to his top form as possible. But, okay, you start with Stanford, Geller's back, Ferry's back, Boyer's back, Rothstart's back. Those are four really, really good players. Of course, USC, Dostinich is back, and you guys all know my thoughts on Stefan Dostinich. Those guys, all outstanding. I mean, you look, I'm trying to think, UCLA, yeah, Drew Baird, very, very good, but no Nanda. We don't know what we're going to get from Smith. Augusta, USD, I'm butchering his name, I apologize, I'm blanking out in the moment. But honest to God, like, you know who belongs in the conversation? Daniel DeJong of Pepperdine. Sincerely, he does. And after watching him this weekend, I was ready to offer the hot take that he is going to be the best player in California this season. The senior out of the Netherlands had a fantastic year last season. I believe it was 12-6 for him at the number two singles position. You look for him this weekend. He was one of the stars of the weekend. Earns a 5-7-6-3 six love win over Johannes Monday on day one. On day two was a 6-4 win over Musatelli. On day three was a 5-7-6-1-6-3 win over Alex Kotzen. And again, hidden dual format, you take it all with a grain of salt, but he was on court number one for the Waves all weekend long. And of course, last season for them, it was Guy Danuden, who has since, I believe, or if he hasn't formally, I believe he's turning pro. I think Parsa dropped the bomb that he's turning pro already, but certainly that is the word on the street regarding that. And so DeJong will be expected to jump in, and Adrian Otsbeck, by the way, also graduating. So those two guys out of the lineup, DeJong is going to be expected, the senior, to jump into that number one singles position. And again, it's an intangible quality. I wish I could describe it. I highly recommend all of you go watch the broadcast. You can find them live on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. He just has a way of getting under the skin of his opponents. And you can't put a price tag on the value of that skill because it's not pretty. You know, he's not going to be winning any awards for, man, most beautiful forehand in the college, or, man, just the way he steps up and cranks that backhand so aesthetically perfect, it's Djokovic-esque. That's not Daniel DeJong. He's going to chop. He's going to throw up a moon ball or two. He is going to step up, slap down the line, and land that ball on the alley, and you're going to say, you're going to be like, what? On the sideline, and just be like, wait, did that went in? Like, you made that? And he is going to slap that, you know, serve down the tee and just do all of these different things. And he's going to fist pump and it's going to throw you off your rhythm because you're just like, what is this guy doing? And it works. And it works. And I think, obviously, again, those are the intangible qualities. It's worth mentioning that DeJong does a lot of different things. And you look for Daniel against, you know, in his first match where he was playing, I believe it was Diallo. It wasn't Diallo in match one. It was Monday in match one, excuse me. You know, he loses that first set 7-5, and he had chances in that first set. But for Monday, you know, he was serving well. He was aggressive. He had opportunities to step up, hit the forehand, move forward, be on his front foot, do the things that Johannes Monday does. But for DeJong, what he started doing was just, A, the way he adjusted, the way he just kept competing in set number two, and the way he adjusted his game. And, you know, I hate to give credit to this man, but I got to give some credit to volunteer assistant coach Martin Redlicky, who was on DeJong from the start, really midway through that first set, and then at the start of the second set, looking at him saying, hey, Daniel, You can win this match. You outplayed him in that first set. It's one adjustment. You got to keep attacking that backhand. Attack the backhand serve. Attack it with depth in the rallies because, you know, Monday does keep his backhand a little bit closer to his chest, and it just felt like when DeJong was able to get some pace into that backhand side, all of a sudden he was the aggressor. All of a sudden he was on his front foot. All of a sudden Monday wasn't able to show off, you know, those net skills and the aggression he can play with moving forward. And then, look, he takes that second set 6-3. He and Marty kind of have a look at each other. There's a smile. DeJong gets the early break for two love, or to go up two love in that third set, and it was lights out from there. You could just tell he had it. Monday was just kind of like, nope, I'm this match. It's not happening for me. You know, his teammates were losing elsewhere as well, which never helps. But you could just tell DeJong had him. And to break down Johannes Monday, who right now number 6 in the ITA rankings. And by the way, Johannes, the way he responded on day 2, I'll get there. Trust me, because the energy he played with on day 2 was so much better. The entire Tennessee team was so much better. I'm not trying to take away anything from the Pepperdine performance. Let me be clear. I'm just trying to clarify and say there was Tennessee on Friday was not Tennessee on Saturday. Tennessee on Friday was blah. Tennessee on Saturday was the 2021 defending semifinalist. And I just, again, it's worth pointing that fact out, but it's also worth pointing out that Pepperdine capitalized on that fact immensely on day one. And you look for them, it started out in the doubles where I thought they competed extraordinarily well. And, you know, for them, they got a win from Halden and fell in over Monday and Gannon 7-5. And you look for, you know, for Halden, for Carlson Halden, who's the freshman for them, for Pietro Feline, who, you know, the sophomore for them, looking for double solutions is Coach Shaq. I know that's a good win for them. That was certainly something he was looking forward to. You look for them doubles on day 2. It was a different team. This time it was Zeke Vogel and Rogers getting a win over Musatelli and LeBlanc on day 3 for them. They swept the doubles. They got better throughout the course of the weekend. It was Rogers, Zeke Vogel, 6th love over Kotsen and Hashimoto. Or excuse me, they didn't sweep the doubles. They took two of the three. It was, you know, Rogers, Zeke Vogel, Carlson, Halden, and Felling. And, you know, again, it wasn't the formal dual match, and I'm butchering his pronunciation. I'm well aware of that fact. I apologize to you, Pietro. I just may call him P moving forward. That's probably a little bit easier for me. But to Pietro and Linus, they just, you know, again, they sustained that level throughout the weekend. I think Rogers and Zeke Vogel, it's just a good team. I mean, Andrew Rogers can freaking play. Just well-rounded game, an aggressive guy, wants to move forward, be at the net. Timmy Z, the lefty, firepower, explosive, the energy of that team as well. I think that's a fun one doubles team. You know, Hadigian, DeJong, for them throughout the course of the weekend, I think they lost all three of their matches. Tough matches, certainly, in each of their matchups, and they played competitive sets in all three. But, look, I thought Pepperdine definitely got better throughout the course of the weekend in doubles and then in singles. I mean, their depth shined through throughout the course of the weekend. And, of course, it started with DeJong up top, who was your MVP. And, again, is he the best player in California this season, the best number one singles player? The answer isn't an unequivocal yes, but it's not an unequivocal no either. And I do think, again, senior, just the experience he has, it's certainly he's the fight he shows. You feel good about that at the top of your lineup going into a lot of your matches. Of course, you look elsewhere for them. I mean, Andrew Rogers shined in his return home to Tennessee, and of course he was part of their run to the semifinals last season, and for Rogers transferring to Pepperdine now in film school, graduate school there. He had the whole Rogers crew there. He's a Tennessee native. The parents came out, the family came out. I will tell you this, and I've said it before, as someone whose family attended each and every match that I played, that's what makes college tennis so special. That atmosphere, fall event, no long-term implications, yet the whole Rogers crew is out enjoying the affair. You just love that. Again, that's what makes college tennis special. And look, Andrew reflected that. He wanted to make it special. He wanted to perform for his family. And look, on match number one, took it to Tennessee freshman Shinsuke Mitsui. And guess what? When you're playing a freshman in his very first match on campus, on a court you have played on more frequently than he has, in an environment you are more familiar with than he is, you should take advantage of that fact. And for Rogers, he just had Mitsui on his back foot the entire time and was just the aggressor from start to finish. And even when Mitsui sort of regained his comfort level, got a break back in that second set, Rogers was like, no, that was a brief blip. Let me get back control of this match and took it through the finish line. And I just thought, you know, again, I thought Rodgers was excellent throughout the course of the weekend. He comes back, fights back to earn that three-set win over Lapidot on day two. And that was just, again, him saying, I am not losing. You know, he was down a break in set number two to Lapidot. Lapidot was cruising, looked to be in control, and Rodgers just kind of flipped the script and found a second gear and just was able to ride that momentum through the finish line. And then for him on day number three, look, I thought he played a good match against Hashimoto. I just thought the talented Columbia freshman, who again I will get to momentarily when I talk about Columbia, he just found his rhythm. I mean, his forehand was bigger than anything Rodgers was doing, and Rodgers couldn't hurt him. And just, you could tell it was kind of the freshman just kind of, it was one of those moments for the freshman where it just kind of clicked for him, and he was playing his best match, and the energy was going his direction, and Rodgers was a bit drained. It was his third match of the weekend, and he had played two physical matches. You know, the first one, super emotional, return back to your courts. Obviously, it's just a fall match, but that match means that you don't want to lose to Tennessee when you're returning from, having transferred from Tennessee. So there's all of that in day number one. Day two was the physical grind, and then, you know, still, I thought he competed really well on day three. Rodgers is going to be top half of their lineup. He's got that sort of talent, and again, you always like a fifth year stepping in and competing. So I thought it was a really good weekend for him. I mean, I love Timmy Zietvogel, just the way he competes, and you look for him overall on the weekend for Timmy Z. 1-2, he lost matches to Emil Hud as well as to JJ Mercer. Gets a win on day three, three sets over Henry Ruger, come from behind. Look, Timmy Z was undefeated last year in the bottom of the lineup for Pepperdine, and does he have the big enough game to step up, be top three for them? I think that's an interesting question, and certainly one that this team will have to answer if they want to compete, you know, not just for their own conference, but to be a Sweet 16 team, to be a national indoor sort of team. You need the depth, 3 through 6, because I like DeJong. I like Rodgers. They're going to compete in every match they play, and I think there are a lot of guys elsewhere in the lineup, whether it's Zietvogel, whether it's, you know, Pietro, whether it's Hadigian, whether it's Carlson, Enrique Luque, I think Samaria. All these guys are rock solid. What the order is right now, your guess is as good as mine, because I will say each of them performed this weekend. For Pepperdine, they earned 4 singles wins against Tennessee. They got wins from DeJong, Rodgers, and then Hadigian over freshman Connor Gannon, Carlson over Angel Diaz. You look on day two for this Pepperdine team, again, they competed extraordinarily well against Kentucky. DeJong, Rodgers, wins on the top two courts. They get a win from Samaria on court number 6. They also get wins at 7 and 8 from Pietro and Enrique Luque. And so, you know, again, then on day three, they earn 5 singles wins over Columbia. They get victories, 6, as I forgot one of the spots. They get wins from DeJong, Zietvogel, Pietro, Hadigi, and Linus, Enrique Luque. All of these guys can play. And that is going to be the question. And it's better to have a lot of questions of saying, well, we've got, you know, 6 guys who can kind of all fit into those 3 through 6 spots than it is to say, well, we've got 2 guys and then we're making it up as we go. Now, the question is, how do these guys begin to distinguish themselves? And it's tough. I mean, again, I suppose Zietvogel is the most aggressive of the group, the lefty. His ability to get to the net, particularly impressive. Although, if you can, you know, stash him at a 5 or a 6 with the lefty one-handed backhand, you know, you kind of like having that sneak attack weapon at the bottom of your lineup. I mean, the Hadigian forehand might be the biggest weapon of any of the Pepperdine singles players not named Rodgers or DeJong. Again, those are your locks. And I know they're getting one more transfer from Cornell at the start of winter as well. But, you know, I do like the Hadigian forehand. I do like it a lot. And when he found his rhythm against Weingart, against Columbia, he looked really, really good in that singles portion. You know, for Linus Carlson, he just competed extraordinarily well this weekend. Get a freshman repetitions, 5, 6 singles. He's going to make a lot of balls. It's going to be tough to get a ball by him. I mean, Samaria, Enrique Luque, they got a lot of guys who make sense as 5s and 6s. Now, the question is, who's 3? Who's 4? If you could sneak Rodgers, if you have Andrew Rodgers as your 4 singles, you're feeling very, very good. You're feeling like you can compete against top 16 teams. If it's, you know, Rodgers at 2, then who's your 3? Who's your 4? That heart of the lineup is where, you know, again, they don't have a Bicknell, a Shelton, an Andrade. Not a lot of schools do, of course, but, you know, even the Stachowiak or Broom of the world at that 4-5, or, you know, just again, who's going to be playing 3 for Ohio State? I think it's Van Emberg this year, or freaking Votzel, or just any of these guys. that's the difference between Pepperdine and perhaps, you know, even a Kentucky. Like, you like Hurrian at three, and you like, four, five, six, actually. That's where things would get interesting. But I do think this Pepperdine team is going to be able to compete everywhere. I think at five and six, they're going to be able to play anyone straight up. They've got that sort of depth. I do think DeJong is going to scrap. Rogers is going to be damn good as well. Doubles for them, and then again, who fills in those 3 and 4 singles position, that heart of the lineup? Because, you know, again, that's to me the interesting question. I do think Pepperdine wins their conference. I think Pepperdine ends up in that, you know, 16 to 25 range. For them to crack that top 16, they need a couple of those guys to click in the heart of their lineup. But again, I thought they competed extraordinarily well this weekend. You look for them against Columbia to be able to get 6 singles victories, against Tennessee to be able to get 4 singles victories. And then, you know, again, even against Kentucky, they got 5 singles victories as well. They competed everywhere. What are the answers at 3 and 4? We will have to wait and see what are the answers at doubles as well. But look, Pepperdine can play. You look for them last season, I believe. You know, they got the big win over USC, upset fashion, 16-7 overall, second round of the NCAA tournament. It depends on the draw, but it's a young USC team. And just since Pepperdine always seems destined to head to USC, or, you know, if they can avoid Stanford from an NCAA regional standpoint, I think that's fair, because I just think Stanford, that's the sort of team 3, 4, 5, 6 and 1 and 2. That's obviously, they're going to be so good this season. But in a USC match, like, with how well this Pepperdine roster knows that USC roster, how little we know about this young USC team, which is turning the page at this point of the year, that's a very interesting match. And so, you know, again, going to be fun to see how Pepperdine competes throughout the course of the season. But that was their performance at the Knoxville Showdown. I talk a lot to Tennessee and Columbia players throughout the course of the weekend. You're going to hear those interviews on the Cracked Interviews podcast, and I make a lot of these points throughout the course of those interviews, so I'll try my best not to repeat myself. So I'm going to be a little bit quicker with these two teams, because again, I think we're going to be talking about that. You know, we haven't talked as much about Kentucky and Pepperdine of late on the shows. I know we are going to be talking about the Ivy League specifically during our preview series, and obviously we've talked tons of Tennessee tennis over the course of the past 9 months. So a little bit briefer on these. Let's start with Columbia, who of course has a million questions entering this season. And it was so great for me to get the chance to speak with Columbia head coach Howard Endelman. You can go hear that podcast right now on the Cracked Interviews feed. I'm not going to lie, it's one of the pods I'm prouder of. I went and listened back to it because, hey, Howie is everything he was talked up to be. There's a lot of story, a lot of Howie love, and, you know, people know Tim Wang, close friend of mine. He obviously went to Columbia, a guy who I grew up playing with, and, you know, he speaks nothing. But you just hear a lot of stories of the legend of Howie, and he lives up to all of them. The kindest guy, the passion is just, he wears that passion on his sleeve, and obviously I like to think I do as well. And so obviously as soon as we get going, it's really, really enjoyable to have the chance to chat with him. So I highly recommend that podcast. But he was blunt when he said, look, we have 8 players between these freshman and sophomore classes. 2 classes, by the way, that both rank top 5, according to Tennis Recruiting, in recruiting classes in the nation. They have 2 recruiting classes, 2 top 5 classes, 8 total players who prior to Labor Day had never stepped foot on Columbia's campus because there was no season for them last year. Columbia opting to cancel, or Ivy Leagues opting to cancel athletics. There was also no in-campus classes for anyone at Columbia last season. And so, you know, again, this is a Columbia team that has been so outstanding over the past, you know, 5 years, 10 years, you want to say 2014 and on. Let's say 2014 and on, just what they've accomplished. They've won the Ivy League 6 times since 2014. They've made 9 Sweet 16 appearances total, I believe, since 2014. That can't be right, because there haven't been 9 since 20. They've made 9 Sweet 16 appearances total. There it is. You look at the NCAA Outdoor Championships, or ITA Indoors, 2018, 19, 20. They qualified. They also did it in 15 and 16. They qualified for the Sweet 16 in 2014, 15, 18, and 19 as well. 46-2 versus Ivy League opponents since 2014. And look, their match that they won over Baylor at the 2020 National Indoors was one of the matches of the tournament. You look for Columbia, they went down that national kickoff, indoor kickoff weekend to Knoxville, Tennessee, beat this upstart Tennessee program that last year made the NCAA semifinals. And look, some of those guys are gone. No more Jack Lynn, no more Jackie Tang, and, you know, the Victor Pham, Tim Wang generation of players, Adam Ambrosi. Those guys are gone. And yet, Coach Endelman in his first three seasons has replaced that talent with immense other, you know, again, replaces the wrong word, but he brings in the sort of caliber of players that are capable, at least on paper, of matching those results. Again, the top five recruits, you bring in a guy like Alex Kotsen, who did have a little bit of, you know, the blue chip, who had some experience, you know, at the start of that 2020 season, but then used all of last year to go travel and play pro events. I believe he played something like 30 different pro events and went, you know, 14-14 so far this year, but has made three quarterfinals now at the 15K level. And just, you know, having spoken to him, got to experience what it's going to take to be a professional, the commitment that it takes, not just, you know, again, from an in-match standpoint, but the work takes match in, match out. When you're, you know, for him, it was, yes, their team practices would start 8:30 every morning. Kotsen's on the court 45 minutes beforehand, getting an individual workout in. And just to have that sort of guy at the top of your lineup, particularly given the inexperience of so many of these players on the roster, it helps immensely. And then, of course, you know, you've got a senior in Austin Hwang who, you know, minimal experience for a senior, sure, but was undefeated at the bottom of the lineup in 2020 and just did have that exposure to the Wang and the Vic Phams and the, you know, that generation, the Jackie Tangs of the world, and knows what it takes to, you know, succeed in the Ivy League, to be a successful Columbia student athlete, and, you know, to buy in and continue the culture that has been built on Columbia's campus. They do have the sort of quality leaders to be able to do that, to be able now. That said, you know, again, you've got those guys, and I don't want to leave anyone out because, of course, I've got a bunch of other talented guys on the lot. You got to look at a guy like Ben Golan who, you know, again, and a team with such minimal experience, every bit of it matters. But you look for this roster, you know, again, eight guys. Theo Weingar, Max Westphal, who, by the way, junior U.S. Open doubles champion, was not down in Knoxville but will be joining the campus shortly. You've got Jaden Templeman, Henry Ruger, Ishan Ravichandar. You've got Roko Horvath, Hugo Hashimoto, Alex Finkelstein. Those eight guys, all top 40 in their classes, blue chip recruits. None of them have stepped foot on campus before this weekend. So as such, you know, coming into this weekend, they had played 3 days of practice, Coach Endelman was telling me. They've been together for three total days before. They threw them into the fire. And why did they do that? Because you will see right away who's got it. Who can rise amongst that, you know, in these circumstances? Who can handle this sort of adversity and still manage to bring forward their best performances and, you know, play their sort of best tennis? And I have to say, the guy who immediately jumped out to me was Hugo Hashimoto. Hugo Hashimoto is going to fit like a hand in a freaking glove in the college tennis world. And, you know, for the first year out of San Jose, was a blue chip recruit, accomplished a lot as a junior. The ball striking right away. His forehand might have been the biggest weapon on the court throughout the course of the weekend. And look, you're going to have to rein in that forehand. You're going to have to learn you can't play Mach 10 at all times, particularly in a college tennis match when you just need to sustain your energy levels and focus for the course of 2 hours, not just for yourself, but for your teammates as well, who are banking on that energy and trying to feed off of it simultaneously. And for Hugo Hashimoto, there were definitely ups and downs. It feels like he came out real hot in his first day match against Joshua Lapidot, and it just felt like it took him so much energy to not only get that first set to a breaker, but to then take that second set 7-5, that by the third, and he's a freshman, by the way, finding his legs, but by the third, he was a little bit gassed. And then you look for him the next day. I thought it was a flatter performance for Hashimoto in his day two result, 4-2 loss to Emil Hudd. Of course, Hudd was one of the superstars of the weekend, and that's a welcome to college tennis. You're playing a 23-year-old man who's hitting the ball big and following it in, and Hudd might not be 23, might be 21. But the point being, you know, you're playing a man now. Hugo Hashimoto's just turned 18 and 19 years old, and just, you know, again, I think That was the reality check, and that's why it was so encouraging to see him on day three knock out Andrew Rodgers and just kind of sustain his energy from start to finish, utilize his big forehand, not get, you know, overwhelmed by the aggressive tactics of Rodgers, who wanted to move forward and put pressure on Hashimoto, and Hashimoto just didn't let him. He served well. He took the return early. You look for Hashimoto. I thought he and Kotsen, despite the 6-love loss on day three, were actually very good throughout the course of the weekend. I know they lost a 6-2 match to Hudden Matsui on day two, but I think Hudden Matsui are excellent. I thought the way they competed 7-5 in their first set on day one, they get that win over Diallo and Musatelli, was a really well-played set, and I just think the energy of that team, that's what you want at the top. You're going to get Hashimoto, who will be loud, enthusiastic, and then always helps to have a Kotsen-type player on court number one, but just that experience as well, the confidence Alex Kotsen brings to the court, that's exactly what you want your freshman to feed off of, that Kotsen. So I actually really like that doubles pairing, despite the fact that they went 1-2. I mean, you look for doubles in general. I think there's a lot. I really like the team of Ruger and Weingar. I just think that team makes sense. I think Theo Weingar, he's going to be in the doubles lineup. Big, aggressive, good hands, quick hands, was always ready at the net when the ball was blasted at him, and I thought they played a particularly good set. Did Weingar on day three against Hadigian and DeJong when he played with Templeman. I thought Weingar was pretty damn good on day two against Wallner and Diaz as well. But, you know, again, it's just so young. That's why I kind of take the doubles results and I throw them out the window for this Columbia team, because they've been together for 3 days and there's no continuity. There's been, you know, again, you haven't had the chance to play doubles together. You haven't had the chance to implement your plays. You haven't had the chance to have Coach Monfiglio sit you down and say, no, we're not doing that anymore. Or just do, you know, whatever it may be, just the way all these players get acclimated to college doubles. And so for Columbia, perhaps doubles at the start of the season is where that lack of 2021 is going to most manifest itself, because, of course, in doubles, repetition is key. You know, experience is key, and they just don't have a lot of that. But they've certainly got the talent. And then, I mean, in singles, look, I mean, Tennessee, I think, went 5-1 against them in singles on day two. That had more to do with Tennessee than it did with Columbia, and I'll get to that momentarily. But you look for them, considering how young they are, inexperienced they are, how little practice they had. They competed everywhere, and, you know, it started for Kotsen, who I think he's going to be top 25 this season. I mean, just a well-rounded game. I said it in the interview. Reminds me of Oliver Crawford and the body type and just the way he moves around the court. You know, the big forehand, moves the ball well with the backhand as well. Confident with the serve. Sneaky, quick twitch athlete. More pop than you would think with a guy with his size. Strong as well. Just the energy he brought to. I mean, he took it to Diallo on day one, two, and three. And then I thought played two really competitive matches. Loses 5-7, 7-6, 7-5 in the third to Johannes Munde, then loses 5-7, 6-1, 6-3 in the third to DeJong of Pepperdine on day three. I mean, he was just in the mix with all of those guys. And considering, again, he hadn't played a college tennis match in 18 months, and, you know, to get thrown back into that, into the Wolves, he was ready for it. And he seemed prepared. And, you know, again, I think for him, that last, you know, set three against DeJong, he got off to a 2-love lead and then just kind of let DeJong get to him. And just, you know, again, he lost his, I don't want to say he lost his composure, but he just kind of lost his fitness level and just, you know, wasn't willing to suffer the way DeJong was. And look, it was a long weekend of tennis for Alex Kotsen. Again, the 3-set match against Monday was so good on day two. That was the highest level from two players start to finish I saw in any match on the day. I mean, you know, 5-7, 7-6, 7-5. They're going serve for serve, stroke for stroke. Kotsen was holding, you know, keeping pace with a guy who's ranked number 6 in the country. And is that good? We know in Johannes Munde. It was excellent. It was just so excellent. And Kotsen's on the level. He's going to give Columbia, with the way he competes and honestly just his level of play, a shot at every match they play, regardless of opponent, at the number one singles position. You look elsewhere again. Hashimoto is going to be in the lineup, the freshman, just too talented. You could tell for Austin Huang, who got the win on day two over Connor Gannon in 3 sets, and, you know, days 1 and 3, straight set losses for him. He's just looking to get his legs back, you could tell, and it was 0-5 for him in the day 3 loss, and I believe for him it was 6-1 for him in the day 1 loss. But I have no no, my confidence in Hwang is not wavering. He'll be in your 5-6 singles position. The senior, just again, guy who knows how to compete, the steadiness, the presence he brings, that energy, that poise. It was felt in the lineup, certainly from top to bottom. But then, I mean, everywhere else is a question. What do you do with, you know, Finkelstein? We didn't get to see play, but talent-wise, certainly we know he's got the goods. And, you know, Max Westphal is coming in. You feel like he's going to get a shot in that lineup as well. Everywhere else, I mean, look, they competed everywhere, whether it's Ruger, Temperman, Weinger, you know, Ravichandar, all of these guys. They, you know, it was a tough weekend for them. There were a lot of, you know, L's across the board because, again, it's such a young team. It's such an inexperienced team, and yet I thought they all competed extraordinarily well. I thought, you know, again, for Henry Ruger to take that first set 7-6 against Timmy Zietvogel when so many things were going against their team in that first set. And I even thought the way Hwang competed in set number two on day three against Pepperdine and just up and down the board, all of these players still trying to find their legs, trying to find the rhythm of a college tennis match. So it's really hard to judge this team based off their results when they had played three total days of practice as a group heading into this Knoxville showdown. But from a talent perspective, it didn't feel like they got blown out on any given court. It didn't feel like, you know, again, that they weren't on the level, that they were playing a different sort of, you know, that they couldn't hang with each of these teams. They were very, very young, but this team can definitely hang. And again, in terms of where they are now to where they will be in May, I could argue that no team will improve more over the next 7 months than these Columbia Lions. So, again, I really like their talent. It's just a lot of young talent. We'll have to be patient. And then finally, on Tennessee, and look, I promise you they're going to be in our top 10 of the preseason rankings, and so we'll have Chris Matt on to do a full preview of this. I don't want to give away the entire store now. They've got their doubles. This is the best doubles team, best doubles point in the country, because I know, and it doesn't even matter what their actual doubles results were this weekend, because A, you start with Hudden Mitsui, who went 2-0 on the weekend, 6-2 over Kotsen and Hashimoto. I believe for them, it was a 6-2 win over Rogers and Zietvogel. That's going to be your number three doubles team. And for Emil Hud, who qualified for the NCAA doubles tournament last season with Matej Vozel, to have him and a top 10 ITF junior in the world freshman whose talent just oozes off of his racket, can do so many different things. His feel, his explosion, his explosiveness. It just feels like when Shinsuke Matsui learns how to play tennis, he's going to be damn near unstoppable. And you have that at three doubles, because at two, you've got the team of Monday and Prada, who were excellent last season. You look for that duo, Monday and Prada, in doubles overall on the year. I believe they go 16-8 at the number two position, 4-0 at one, 20-8 overall in the dual match season, and you bring them back with a year more experience. And then at number one, you have the defending NCAA champions, and your number one team in the country entering the preseason in Walton and Harper. This team didn't lose many doubles points last year. I think there was three doubles points that they lost. They lost the doubles point, yeah, to North Carolina at the National Indoor in that quarterfinal match. They lost the doubles point to Florida when they played in the dual match. They lost the doubles point to LSU. No, excuse me, to Arkansas, I believe. Yeah, that was the doubles point. No, to LSU, excuse me, on 4-9. And that was it. Those were their doubles points. Oh, and then they dropped the doubles point to Georgia, excuse me, in the NCAA quarterfinals. But the point being, this team didn't drop many doubles points last season. And they bring in a team in Hud and Matsui that just, if you play them at three, I just think Tennessee's going to be up 1-0 on everyone. That's just, there's so much talent in their plays. And just, again, this is a team that gets better at doubles throughout the course of the year as well. And they already look this good. Even if you want to, you know, even if you say Hud and Matsui at two, and then you get Joe Monday at three with freaking Prada. Like, what makes Tennessee so scary is they're going to start nearly every match up 1-0. And then, look, there was no Walton this weekend, and, you know, Harper still injured as well. But, you know, Monday lost his first match, three sets, fine, 2-0. He bounces back. That three-set match played against Kotsen, as I mentioned, was the highest level I saw from two opponents playing simultaneously on a court this weekend, and Monday was able to come through that match. And the fact that he might be two singles again, where, you know, last year for Johannes Monday was 19-5 overall at the two singles position, that he might play again behind Walton. You feel good if he's at two. You feel good if they switch it even, and you get Walton at two and Monday at one. You feel good about your top two. You look for Prada last season was 13-9 at the three singles position. Look, even if he keeps that spot, that's great, but you want to throw Emile Hutt in there, who was 2-0 this weekend, didn't drop a set, looked dominant, and of course was a top 100 player in the nation last season. You feel good about who's ever at four. Whether it's Hutt, whether it's Prada, you feel like your four's a lock. And then, look, that's big for them, because last year, Wiedemann, Hussey were locks at four, and then Matsui maybe at the start of the year takes some lumps, but that's going to be as talented as a number five singles player as you are going to see in the country. And, you know, again, this weekend, he already got immensely better between match number one, where he loses straight sets to Rogers, and match number two, where he beats Colombia's Roko Horvat 7-6-6-1. And just look for Matsui. Again, give him some time, because he's got a ton of talent, great feel, great power, great athleticism, just a springy athlete, really, really enjoyable to watch. Again, I think those are five guys for sure. I think all five of those guys are going to be in the Tennessee singles lineup, and I'm trying not to give away the whole ball game here, but the question is six. Wallner, is it Gannon, is it Angel Diaz, is it... You know, again, who is it? Who is the number six singles player for this Tennessee team? I thought Wallner looked the best of the bunch this weekend. You look for him, Wallner, two wins, I believe, in both of his matches, 2-0. And again, he's the fifth-year senior. If you have a fifth-year senior at six singles, you always feel good when you've got a vet who's physically, just again, the way Wallner competes, a guy who's been in the program now for a couple of years, just knows what it takes. You always feel good about that. Really like the game of Connor Gannon. Very forehand-centric, but that forehand, very, very nice. And then just the way Angel Diaz competes, that's perhaps your most typical number six singles. And I haven't even mentioned Pat Harper, who is, of course, not healthy right now. But, you know, when he gets healthy, we know the sort of player he can be. Tennessee's very good. They're very, very good. And I think their ceiling is defined by how quickly they can get Matsui from freshman to, you know, capitalizing on his talent within the lineup and playing to his talent instead of playing to his age. But, oh, my. I mean, the other thing about Tennessee, oh, do you want me to give it all away right now? I can hear your answers. Yes, they're saying, Alex, give it all away right now. They don't fear Florida. They just don't. Like, again, go back to the 2019 matches where they beat them in Gainesville in the SEC tournament. And yes, Florida beat them in the NCAA tournament. But look, last year, Florida beats them in the regular season. Tennessee beats them in the SEC tournament. And I know Florida is the big bad boy on the block. They are the one everyone is chasing, justifiably so. When you bring back everyone plus Seymour plus a freshman, yeah, that team is damn freaking good. But Tennessee doesn't fear those guys. And the one thing Tennessee has going for them, and you could argue Texas maybe does as well, though a little bit less so because, again, that was a young Texas team and it's not the same. These Tennessee players have beaten Florida before. They've seen what it takes to beat that team. They're going to go into that match and say, well, you know, Walton goes in, I've beaten Valle. Monday goes in, I've beaten Riffis. Prada goes in, I've beaten Andrade. All of these guys, you know, Hud's not going to be afraid of anything. And so Harper's like, please. And so, again, that you can't fake that quality, that intangible quality. And what was so impressive for Tennessee in a weekend without Rogers, Walton, without Harper, after as bad as they were on day one, and I mean, it was flat as can be. Just no energy, no inspiration, no go vols, no pumping up from court to court. And they were, you know, again, without Coach Woodruff or Coach Mackay on day one, but they lost four singles matches against Pepperdine on day one, and they were just flat, and they just didn't have the energy. And you look in those four singles losses, only one of those losses went three sets. They didn't even show that fight to come back and force a third. But then on day two, I mean, yes, it helps to play a young Columbia team, but they executed up and down the board. Straight set wins in four of their five singles victory. Monday has the comeback victory over Kotsen as well, which is an extraordinarily high-level match. I thought Connor Gannon played really well to fight back after dropping his first set to force a third. It was a completely, they swept the doubles, completely different Tennessee team on day two. That's the sort of team that you look at, even, you know, to have that sort of performance without Walton at the top of their lineup. That's the team you look at. Oh, yeah, that was the NCAA semifinalists. And so, you know, again, Tennessee's damn good. And that's not a revelation to anyone, and I expect them to be damn good here this season as well. But look, that was your 2021 Knoxville Showdown. I hope I did about 15 minutes on each of those teams, gave you all a primer of the action we saw, gave you all a little bit of an update on where each of those teams stand. Of course, as I mentioned at the top, college tennis preview content it's coming soon, folks. We're about a month away from the rollout of how we plan to cover this 2022 season. A lot of exciting stuff in the works. So we hope, of course, you all stick with us throughout. And again, we are super grateful to the University of Tennessee, Coach Woodruff, Coach Mackay, everyone on campus for being willing to have us down there, being willing to allow us to cover the event, because, of course, I know how much they care about growing the game, and we appreciate them allowing us the opportunity to do so. So again, a huge thank you to everyone down at Tennessee, and be on the lookout for all of those conversations from the Knoxville Showdown on the Cracked Interviews podcast over the course of the next few weeks. But again, with all that said, to find all the content, crackedrackets.com. Like, rate, subscribe, review to this show, Cracked Interviews podcast, Mini Break podcast, and everything we're doing here at Cracked Rackets. Of course, if you need the more immediate updates, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, we are at Cracked Rackets. You want to message me directly, I am at Great Shot Pod. A shout out, as always, to our super producers, Max Fliegner and Daniel Westhoff, for the of an editing job they do day in, day out. Shout out as well to our friends at Tennis Point, tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15. With that said, for super producers Fliegner and Wostoff, our friends at Tennis Point, from all of us here at both Cracked Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. You know what we say. Hey, great shot, and we will see you all next time. Thanks, everyone.